Welcome to the Creative Language Technologies Podcast. I am Roxana Guruju, your creative host, bringing you information on the multifaceted aspects of this emerging field at the intersection of science, technology, engineering, math, and medicine with the broader sector of humanities, social sciences, arts, and culture. The podcast aims to revitalize technological imagination and explore creative themes with social impact. We hope to build a community of creatives by stimulating interest in new modes of collaboration and creation processes that represent diverse disciplinary views and help transform current practices of language technologies. Here is the show. This is episode number 11 of the podcast, and it's Thursday, the 10th of February, 2022. It was my pleasure to talk today to Dr. Laura Otis, who comes from a background in biochemistry, neuroscience, and laboratory research, but she is now an English professor at Emory University. She is the author of multiple academic but readable books on the relationship between literature and science, and she has also published 6 novels. In her blog on creativity for Psychology Today, she writes about how the thinking of creative writers and scientists is connected. Laura tries always to write and talk so as to respect the intelligence and ways of knowing of people in very different fields who build knowledge differently. We started the discussion with the definition of thought, focusing on different ways people think and remember. Laura thinks that people's mental worlds vary greatly, believing that the world's 7 billion mental worlds are similar gives us just a crude, limited, and unrealistic picture of what human thinking involves. In fact, according to her, is thinking visual or is it verbal is the wrong question to ask. In her interviews with subjects, Laura has also tried to see if there is any connection between thinking, feeling, and the senses as she asks her subjects questions like, what do you see when you read? Or what senses predominate in your memories? In the second part of the show, we discussed her new project, a book called The Neuroscience of Craft, on how fiction writers and scientists can benefit from each other's knowledge about sensory systems. Here is the show. Hello, Laura. It is very nice to have you on the show.
Hi. Well, thanks very much for inviting me. I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, yes, me too. So people seem to be different in their way they think and remember things. In your book, you mentioned that your mental world, for example, functions more acoustically. You know if a coin is a quarter just by the sound it makes as it touches the ground. You prefer to shake your purse to find the corner in which the keys are instead of taking everything out first, like most of us do. In fact, transcribing the voices you hear in your mind into dialogues in your fiction books comes very naturally to you. I, on the other hand, seem to be more visually inclined. I remember, for instance, years back in school, being very good at two-dimensional and three-dimensional geometry, able to rotate complex objects and move points in my mind to find their geometric loci. A locus is this path traced by a point subject to some given conditions. For instance, the geometric object created by a point which moves such that it is at a constant distance of a fixed point. This actually generates a circle in 2D or a sphere in 3D. So such mental processes are absolutely fascinating, and this is the topic of our discussion today. So let's start from the beginning, though. First, you've made, I'd say, a quite radical professional change of direction in your career. You moved from neuroscience to literature. And as such, in your research, you combine science with literature and writing, looking at how different people think at their lived experience of thought. But first, how do you define thought, and when and how did you start to work on this research topic?
Okay, it's hard to define thought, but I'd say it's It's focused mental activity of which people are usually aware, and that's usually directed towards some purpose. It's not always the case. Sometimes a thought will just occur to you, but it's generally thought of which you're aware. So yes, yeah, so it's a working definition, which I'd be happy to alter as I think more about it.
We will as we go. And how did you start to work on this book?
Okay, it's because I've worked in so many different fields. I don't want to say that everybody in science thinks one way or everybody who studies literature thinks one way, but I've come, you know, in moving from science to literature to history of science, to narrative psychology, history of emotions, you know, all these different areas. I've just come across a lot of different kinds of people who think in different ways. And I've been struck by some people's self-confidence that everybody must think the way that they do. It's been, you know, sometimes frustrating, sometimes amazing to listen to such people. And I wanted to write Rethinking Thought just to promote awareness of how different it can feel to be in different people's heads, and especially to promote respect for different ways of thinking, which are equally valid and can work equally well, depending upon context.
Yes, absolutely. Very, very important topic, which has a special place on this podcast as well. In fact, you like to joke that thinking is like going to the toilet. We don't know what the experience is like for other people, and we rarely talk about it. We do make assumptions about this experience, and we believe it is rather similar, but we don't know for sure. However, we stand on very shaky ground here. This assumption has huge implications for human communication and education, just to list a few applications. Believing that the world's 7 billion plus mental worlds are similar gives us a crude, limited, and unrealistic picture of what human thinking involves. What are the implications of this assumption when it comes to how we get ideas, how do we develop them, and communicate them?
Okay, well, the toilet analogy goes only so far. Yeah, the reason I'm came up with something so radical is that I wanted to stress, you know, how little we talk about the personal experience of thinking, so what it feels like to think in your own head. And so I don't know if I want to stand by that toilet analogy, but we, you know, in both cases, we know so little about, you know, let's just forget the toilet. we know so little about what it feels like to think in for other people. We can, by reading, you know, you might get that, but then again, you're usually getting fictional characters. So for the sake of neuroscience and medicine, I'm very happy for what people have in common, which is enough that, you know, we can develop a vaccine that works on different people, or that if someone develops a brain tumor, we know where to look for it. I mean, modern medicine can work because of what people have in common. But even given everything that we have in common anatomically, physiologically, there are still enormous differences from person to person in terms of the ways that people remember, solve problems, approach relationships. And so I think that, you know, with all the creativity that we're going to need to save humankind from the position that we've gotten ourselves into, it's best that we honor and respect and listen to all the differences between people.
This actually leads us to our research practices, right? So how we actually look at this. We seem to get a different answer, though, depending on whom we ask. For instance, lab experiments under controlled conditions have been the de facto practice in many fields, if not all scientific fields. And for some good reasons, they make it easy to control over extraneous variables and for others to replicate our studies. There are important limitations as well, though. The focus on shared human traits, identifying common features to produce data that researchers can trust. But on the other hand, qualitative studies like those examining personal introspections tend to focus on individual differences. You, as well as others, believe we need a paradigm shift here. Instead of seeing individual differences as noise, we should look at them as data. Specifically, how do you see these research practices as complementary? What they can together do for us?
Okay, yeah, I wouldn't ever want to give up laboratory experiments. I've done them. That was the way I was really trained to do research, and I've never lost my respect for it. Especially experimental psychology and neuroscience. We can just learn so much from that. I would advocate a system of building knowledge with complementary approaches. One very respected one would be laboratory experiments, but I think we do need to complement. Well, one other thing I should say is that in neuroscience and psychology, there's increasing interest in individual differences. Since maybe about 2005, certainly the scientists have always been aware of it. I don't think anyone has ever wanted to dismiss it completely. It's something to think about. It's something to talk about. It's just not something you can necessarily publish in your paper, but it's something that you keep in mind. So I don't think that individual differences are excluded from neuroscience or psychology, but you have to make some compromises if you're going to design a study. So I'd say that in parallel with really rigorous scientific laboratory research, it would be great if we could have even more introspective narrative type psychology studies that take individual differences into account. I know there are some people who would maintain that, what we think about thinking has nothing to do with what's actually going on in terms of neurons communicating with each other, that, the experience of thinking doesn't really reveal anything at all. And I don't agree with that. And I think that you can learn from people's phenomenological experiences of what's going on in their heads. The book that I'm working on right now is called The Neuroscience of Craft. And I've taken four writers whom I admire greatly in terms of the ways they describe sensory experiences. And I'm interested in how they use words to get readers to imagine in more than one sense at the same time. It's a really good writer in the first paragraph of her story or his story can get you hearing and smelling and seeing and touching everything that the character is experiencing and blend them all together as you would in real life. In neuroscience right now, it's by no means clear how inputs from different senses are bound together, to create one representation of an object or an experience. And my idea is that writers intuitively know something about that. There's something about the way they create their descriptions that get everybody's senses going at the same time. Every reader is going to respond differently. I shouldn't have said everybody, but something will happen in every reader's mind, which is likely to involve more than one sense. And so how do they do that? And I'm interested in, not only what other writers can learn about that, but what scientists can learn about that. Yeah, it's going to be called The Neuroscience of Craft. And there, that's just an example of how one individual writer who's very gifted, at getting people to imagine things might have something to offer to scientists who are somebody might be able to look and see what that writer is doing and then design an experiment that would be more controlled.
Yeah, these are great, great questions. And you are right. We still don't know what is going on there. We don't know what is going on in people's minds when they try to embody to a particular extent the experience of the character. So in fact, you say that a picture might be worth 1,000 words, but the word is actually more than 1,000 pictures or something like that, if I quote you correctly.
It all depends on who's reading it. Even in the 19th century, Johannes Müller, who's one of the scientists I've studied, came up with the law of specific sense energies, which says that it's the receiving organ that makes a sensation what it is. It's not so much the nature of what's being analyzed, it's the organ that's perceiving it. And so that's true with the mind. You know, a writer, like, for example, the word crisp in English, you know, it can suggest sounds. You know, in vision, it can suggest a sharp edge. It can be the feel of something in your mouth. You know, it's one word, but it's going to trigger a lot of different memories and appeal to a lot of different senses.
Yeah, and some people actually perceive it even visually.
Yeah.
So it's really amazing. In fact, cognitive scientists talk about differences in style of thinking, what they call cognitive styles. In relating to the popular studies claiming a visual-verbal divide of ways of thinking, the imaginary debate, you believe that is thinking visual or is it verbal is the wrong question to ask. What is this visual-verbal spectrum approach to thinking? Does language make thinking possible? Is there thought without language? If you don't mind, to summarize for us here some of the most important historical and present-day research of the mind.
Sure. I'd say, first of all, the concept of visual thinking was already an improvement. It's in the 70s, to say, where educators started talking about, you know, maybe visual or verbal thinking styles. And that was a huge improvement over the idea that there was a thinking style, you know, and people either could do it well or they couldn't. And, you know, there were kids who were great at picturing things in their minds or wanting to build things or do things. And they would get bad report cards because they weren't good at memorizing words, which is what a lot of people, educators, thought thinking was. So, you know, already having the visual category was an improvement. But I think having two categories and then asking people which one are you is no good. We need to improve on that. So certainly Howard Gardner's idea of multiple intelligences has been an improvement that goes back to the 1980s. You know, he deserves a lot of credit for thinking about kinesthetic intelligence, you know, being able to reason through things in terms of how you move your body, musical intelligence. You know, that also, he's warned people that can get out of hand too, because there, you know, if there are 1,000 intelligences, then the idea isn't worth that much anymore. But just the open-mindedness of that approach was, you know, I think has helped a lot of people. Another problem with the, you know, strict binary division between visual and verbal was, well, first of all, what is language anyway? You know, if you're reading, you're using your eyes, so that's visual. I think, like, say, people who win spelling bees, you know, are they seeing it? Are they hearing it? That, you know, that it's a multimodal skill. And then finally, Maria Kozhevnikov, who is a cognitive science researcher and neuroscientist, has put together a lot of evidence in the past 2 decades that what we think of as visual thinking is not one category. There are people who are very good at spatial reasonings, which would be things like, how far away is something? How fast is it moving? What direction is it moving in? What are its relative proportions? And then there's object visualization, which is more, you know, is it furry? What kind of detail is on its surface? What color is it exactly? You know, visual detail, color, shape. And her experiments are showing that people who are very good at spatial reasoning, you know, may not be so good at object visualization and vice versa. You know, there are people who are maybe equally good at both, but if you're very good at one, you know, you may not be so good at another. And those two types of visual skills correspond to two different streams of processing in the visual system. You know, one of which, the dorsal stream, does more spatial analysis and talks a lot to the motor system about, you know, how far away is it? What's it doing? Is it moving towards me? And the ventral stream, which moves out towards the ear, is more involved with identification, resolution of visual detail. It's a different kind of processing. So, yeah, so the problem with just visual or verbal classification is that visual can be a lot of different things and verbal can be a lot of different things. So it's been an improvement, you know, to honor visual thinking, and we should keep going because there are so many different ways of thinking. I was going to have a chapter in Rethinking Thought called None of the Above. And then I decided that was kind of insulting and it lumped too many things into one category. You know, I maybe wasn't so respectful. So, you know, I'm continuing to think about all the possibilities myself.
Yes, for sure. So in this embodied experience quest, you are also focusing on the way thinking feels. Please introduce us to your interview-based study, your participants, your interview design, your finding analysis, and how did your training, your language, your cultural orientation, memories even, as an investigator, influenced the study?
Okay, I had to learn how to conduct interviews. You know, it's not something that you can just walk in and do. You know, I thought I could do that. And I had to learn, you know, to stop telling people what I thought, you know, and like I get as much as I could out of them without influencing what they were saying. You know, I thought it was a regular conversation. Several interviewees would say to me, Laura, do you really think you should be telling me this? You know, aren't you concerned that you're influencing the data? Oh, gee. So,
but we always do that, right? Irrespective of the kind of research and the analysis we do, yeah. We do. And in fact, it has become troubling in some sciences, at least, and I would say artificial intelligence for sure, that we don't talk about it. We don't.
Yeah.
And we know that we do influence it.
Yeah. And so I think that like some of the people who are telling me this were scientists, you know, who were not interviewers. And they, I think it's a fantasy that you can conduct an interview and not put any of yourself into it. It's like Freud saying, oh, well, the analyst must be a mirror, you know, and sort of reflect back everything that the person he's talking to is saying without revealing anything of himself. But of course, that's not what he did. So let's see. So I'm getting sidetracked into the, you know, my initial problems. But the idea was to find people whose thought I believed would be quite different. So whose ways of thinking I suspected would be quite different, including people who had told me, you know, they were sure that thinking was verbal or they were sure that thinking was visual. And then everything in between and things that I would never have expected. So I spoke to the people, you know, it's very limited. I didn't speak to humanity. You know, I spoke to, for the most part, professional people, most of whom were native speakers of English, scientists, artists, writers. There was one flamenco dancer. There was a singer, a photographer. They tended to be... See, not all of them had come from wealthy backgrounds, but, you know, most of them were in, I'd say, the middle class by the time I talked to them. So this is, you know, this is a teeny little slice of humanity, but I still think it was possible to learn from these people, because even in a slice this small, you know, the variety was just staggering. You know, I came across ways of thinking that had never occurred to me. For instance, the programmer I spoke to, there was a person who designed multi-agent software, which is, you know, it's a system in which there are different parts, each of which keeps changing. Although I didn't need to explain it to you, but there might be somebody listening who doesn't know. So it's a system in which there are different components, each of which is changing and each of which affects the other. And so I said, oh, you know, when you're designing a system like that, do you see it? No. Well, do you hear it? You know, do you imagine it in words? No. He says, I run it in my head. I said, oh, well, you know, does that mean you're picturing the different parts? No, it means I'm running it in my head. And I, you know, I couldn't understand what he was saying, but I didn't want my shortcomings to prevent somebody else from understanding it. You know, so I just took down exactly what he was telling me. And I think that, you know, that other people will understand it. It has happened to me in the past that, you know, I've told one person, okay, so it's happened in the past that someone has told me something about his way of thinking that I didn't understand and made no sense to me. And I've told it to another person exactly as he told it to me, and the other person has gotten it. So it, you know, it's possible to communicate even if you don't understand what you're communicating. And so I, you know, on that premise, I wanted to include exactly what he and some of the other people told me.
Right. These are very, very challenging aspects of people's mental processes. And it's not easy to really pinpoint the right list of questions to ask.
Exactly.
It's really individual. In fact, some of your questions in your interview were, do you see anything when you read? What senses predominate in your memories? Like a novelist who tries to encourage a reader to embody whatever the character is experiencing. You believe that questions like how do people hear, what receptors do they have, are relevant to writing as much as they are to health or sales or other areas. People's preferred modes of thinking reflect their relationships with their bodies, the unique way each person experiences the body that grounds their mind. What role do the senses and emotions play in the way people think?
Oh, they're completely enmeshed with each other. I think, you know, since the work of Antonio Damasio in the 1990s, since Daniel Goleman's books on emotional intelligence, people have gotten it. You know, it's taken a while, but I need to keep working on it. You know, maybe I'm living a sheltered life because I'm working right now with a group of researchers who work on the history of emotions. And so I'm getting emotions all around me. But maybe we can say it relatively rather than absolutely, that there's more interest in emotion and there's more respect for emotion in relation to thought. I think there's less tendency to think of thought as something which must exclude emotion in order to be respectable. That, you know, it's really an illusion that emotion takes no part in thought, and certainly the senses do too. You know, how do we, in order to imagine, you know, let's say you're making a decision and you're imagining, you know, what would happen if I do this, what would happen if I do that? To imagine, you have to have something to imagine with, right? Your imagination consists of something. And all you have to work with is your experiences, you know, your physical sensory experiences, and things people have told you, which involves using your experiences to imagine what that person experienced. So it's indirect, but it's the same thing. So I can't imagine that there could be thought that's somehow separate from bodily experiences and emotions.
Yes, in sciences, we've liked to place phenomena into buckets to really narrow things down. And this has been with particular purposes, of course, it's understandable. So in fact, in algorithms, there are algorithms that say, well, if something is very complex, split it into smaller problems and then combine the solutions of these smaller problems to get the solution of the bigger problem. But we know that the solution to the bigger problem is more than just the sum of the parts. And at times, we forget to put the parts together even. So we do need even more awareness in some parts of sciences, definitely artificial intelligence, because we are still separating emotions from senses and from thought. All a very important part in this embodied experience.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I think to imagine how a crowd of 1,000 people are going to behave, you can't take the behavior of one model human and multiply it by 1,000, because they're all going to be doing things to each other. You know, this is the multi-agent software. You know, one guy's going to push the other guy and then fight might break out, and anything could happen in a crowd. You can't presume that everybody in the crowd is going to behave the same way. And then not only that, but when they're all together, they're going to be interactions that lead to unpredictable events.
Right. That's why I actually liked very much your analogies. And I found the questions that you ask, such as, what do people hear, right? what receptors do they have when they interact are very, very relevant, in particular to communication, right? Any aspect of communication.
Yeah, I have to give credit to Scott Gilbert for the receptor analogy. That was not my metaphor. You know, that was his idea. He's a biologist, a developmental biologist, and he loves teaching. He works on turtles. He used that when I interviewed him. We were talking about how he taught. And he said, you know, before you teach anybody anything, before you can teach anybody anything, you have to find out what receptors they have. Because you can throw as much neurotransmitter at them as you want. You know, if they don't have the receptor, nothing's going to happen. And so you have to start by sort of scanning them, seeing what they know, what they need to learn, you know, and you start from there. So Scott Gilbert came up with the receptor metaphor.
Right. That's why processing and understanding dialogues actually is not a trivial process by any means, because we are constantly negotiating meaning, trying to figure out what is the other thinking? How am I going to really connect to the other person? And we do not actually have a recipe for this. Yeah. That's why sometimes our interpersonal communication doesn't go very well. Yeah. So talking about communication, one of the most important applications of this is actually education. Many educational systems worldwide today tend to emphasize this verbal intelligence, which, of course, is no doubt important in politics and social relations, among others. How can people with different thought styles learn to communicate with each other better? You believe teachers of any subject must consider the needs of verbally, spatially, and pictorially oriented students. They should not, however, simply accept the students are verbal or visual or other category, and should focus instead on their individual needs. As educators, how can we best teach our students?
Oh, yeah. So my mother was an elementary school teacher. And, you know, I grew up hearing about things she was doing with her students. So I'd say, you know, I'm concerned about people jumping into categories and not challenging themselves. So I think a good approach would be for teachers to, you know, to tell students, first of all, that, you know, there are these different ways of thinking. There's this and there's that. You know, which one do you think you might be? And so they can think about, I think I might be this. And, you know, very often the kids would be right. So you can say, okay, we'll let you do it this way, but you have to learn the other ways too, you know, so that you can talk to the people who are good with words. Or, you know, I think if people are challenged to try every style, even if they're allowed to work mostly in their own style, they're going to become better communicators eventually. One of the big surprises from the Rethinking Thought book was how many people had gone into fields that challenged them. That, you know, I kind of expected, if somebody's good at this, then she's going to go into science. And a lot of the people in science, one of the questions I asked was, what's hard for you? You know, what's the most difficult thing you ever had to learn? And, you know, no life lessons, you know, don't tell me about your bad breakup, but, you know, tell me about something, a skill or something academic that was hard for you to learn. And a lot of people in science said math. You know, calculus was the hardest thing they had to learn. And then somebody who'd become, you know, one of the most respected translators in the humanities said learning to read was the hardest thing for him. You know, one person told me straight out that he was the director of a research institute, that he wouldn't have wanted to do anything that was easy for him because it wouldn't have been any fun. You know, he wanted to do what was hardest, which for him was, you know, involved words. And so I think people can learn to do things that are hard for them. Like I'm a klutz. I'm always dropping things, crashing into furniture, but I'm trying as hard as I can to play the piano and the guitar. And I think, you know, if I can do that, then anybody can do anything. You know, it's really good for you to try to do something you're not good at, as long as there's not somebody, you know, some mean sadistic person telling you, oh, you're so klutzy, oh, you're so bad. if you're doing it and being encouraged, you know, it's probably going to be quite good for your brain.
For sure. And there are also other implications here, right? So, for example, how to really translate from one way of thinking to another. It doesn't mean that if I actually see or perceive the world visually, it's wrong, right? And for example, some people are actually very good at writing. They are good with words, but in writing and not necessarily when it comes to speaking.
Right. Yeah, or even something like foreign languages, you know, learning another language is not one skill. It's maybe 50 skills. You know, there's so many different aspects to it. There are people who are very good at sort of repeating things back and imitating sounds, you know, like parrots. But if you give them a grammar test, they fail. You know, and then there's the person who gets perfect grade on every grammar test, and you take them to the country and you can't say a word. And everything in between, you know, there are people who are great at the grammar and at imitating the sounds. There are people who are terrible at both. You know, anything is possible. That, you know, things that we've thought of as one skill are very often many different skills woven together.
Yeah, very interesting aspects of thinking. Now, why did you decide to continue this kind of research, right? Because you are actually working on a book right now, which I think it's a continuation of Rethinking Thought. Is it true?
Yeah, it's funny. I hadn't thought of it that way, but it is. I've taken sort of a turn with it, which is since publishing Rethinking Thought, I've earned a Master's of Fine Arts degree in fiction. I decided to get serious about my fiction writing. I've been writing novels since the late 1990s, but you know, as I've been getting older, my poor mother got early onset dementia when she was only in her early 60s, you know, which is just a little bit older than I am now. And it's scary, you know, knowing that in 5 years, your brain might not be working at all anymore. And you know, hopefully that won't happen, but if it does, I wanted to get my novels out there. And so I thought, you know, if I'm going to do this, I need to learn as much as I can about how to become a better writer. So for 2 years, from 2015 to 2017, I earned this degree and learned about writing. And when you earn an MFA in fiction, you don't just learn how to write yourself. You study other people's writing, you know, same as if you were learning to be a painter, you study other people's techniques. And learning how to do that kind of craft analysis, which is sort of how-to analysis, was very mind-opening for me. And so that it's that new dimension that's allowed me to start this new project. You know, I'm looking as hard as I can about how four different writers. So it's Juno Diaz, who wrote The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, Arundhati Roy, who wrote The God of Small Things, Ivan Vira, a Zimbabwean writer who wrote The Stone Virgins, and Edwidge Dondicott, Haitian-American writer who wrote Breath, Eyes, Memory. What they have in common is they're brilliant at sensory descriptions. So I thought I would take the four of them and, you know, because I've been working with historians are very strict about, you know, what time period are you looking at? You can't just say every writer of all time, you know, pick a time period. So I picked contemporary writers of the digital age from about 1995 up to the present, and writers who were writing in English, although all of these novels contain words from other languages. And, you know, just see how are they appealing to readers' imaginations so that readers can imagine more than one sense at once? You know, that's kind of the question. And absolutely, it's related to Rethinking Thought, because I'm thinking, you know, what's going on in the mind of the reader?
Yes, very important questions, and also very, very close to my own research interest. How easy do you think it is for people to talk about the way they think, the emotions they experience, this embodied experience that they have? And do you differentiate between experts and novices? It seems you do, because in Rethinking Thought, you had this wide range of expertise, right? And because there are all these different areas, professions as well. While in this book, the one that you're working on right now, we you are actually narrowing down to fiction writers. Am I right?
Yeah, I can't know anything about what's going on in the minds of the writers based on their fiction. I mean, that would be a false inference to make. You know, I'm more interesting in, you know, how might their words affect readers? And I'm not presuming one kind of reader either. You know, anything could potentially happen in a reader's mind. Or, you know, there are people who are reading and they're responding and they're not necessarily forming any kind of mental images at all. You know, they may be responding some other way. But yeah, I'm interested in, you know, how is it that we can look at words on a page and experience a whole world, you know, in our own ways. I was just working on an article today that somebody asked me to write about how what you read when you were a child has influenced the person that you've become or your way of being. And that was, you know, that was very revealing. It was something I hadn't thought about before. I thought, okay, what books did I like? Pippi Longstocking. You know, who were my heroes? And pretty fast, I started to, oh my God, you know, I've ended up just like these kids in the books that I like to read. What you read really does influence the person that you become. You know, it shows you possibilities of ways of being. And so how do writers do that?
True. We need to focus on this particular aspect of what you just mentioned in the way we process language, including linguistics.
Yeah.
As yeah. Also in any aspect of interpersonal communication.
There are different kinds of knowledge and there are different ways of building knowledge. In English, all these different kinds of knowledge get lumped together in the word knowledge. You know, in Spanish, at least you have saber and conocer. And, you know, in French, you have savoir and connaître. At least, you know, you could divide them into two, where there's one is more hands-on familiarity and one is more learning facts for a test. But there, you know, they're more than two. You know, there's so many different ways of building knowledge. And our cultures don't respect the different kinds of knowledge equally. You know, you get paid a lot more if you have a certain kind of, you know, if you know how to design a bridge, you know, you're going to get paid a lot more than somebody who's an expert on knowing when to change a baby. You know, there are people who are experts at, you know, at caregiving, at knowing when somebody needs another blanket or when somebody's hungry. And they don't tend to get paid very much, but their knowledge matters. You know, they've built their knowledge through a lifetime of experience. And I, you know, my approach to scholarship and living is that we need to honor and respect every kind of knowledge and every way of building knowledge. And, you know, as I said before, in the situation that we're in, we're going to have to draw on all these different kinds of knowledge to save ourselves.
Yes, it's interesting because in some industry sectors, such as cybersecurity, mm-hmm. people have already started to hire people with all sorts of expertise, which apparently they don't have anything to do with cybersecurity.
Yeah.
And it's precisely because they want different ways of thinking, different ways of solving problems.
Yeah.
And it will be very good to see this more and more in other areas as well, in research and in academia also. When with my students, I don't know about you, but with my students, I always think, what should I do to really bring the best out of this student? Because definitely they have their own interests and their own aspects that they consider important and things that they are good at. And yeah. I need to discover that so that our student researcher professor collaboration actually produces very good results. And it's fascinating because everybody's different.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's important to encourage them and keep them going with the things that they're good at while nudging them to do things that they're not so good at, you know, from which they may learn even more. One thing I do in literature classes, I started giving creative assignments. I'm trying, sometimes students get scared by that if they've never done creative writing before, but it's been inspiring to see people discover that they're actually very good at it. You know, like they might never even have tried it before and they're very good at it. And it's a skill, to write well creatively, you have to be able to imagine other people's perspectives. Imagine the perspective of somebody who's very different than you are and how they might experience the world. And that's a skill you could use in almost any field.
Right. I think this is actually the best thing to do as educators. You're right. Yeah. It's not only building on the skills that they already have, but showing them that they have actually great potential in probably other aspects that they don't see as important or they don't really yeah. believe too much in. If you could share some of the findings so far that you have found surprising in your new research, if you can actually share with the audience.
Okay. Let's see. I'm trying to think what is surprising. I've noticed one technique which it shouldn't have been surprising because it makes so much sense, but it felt like I discovered that authors will very often combine a short range sense with a long range sense. Vision and hearing, you're gathering inputs from a greater distance. People vary from one to another how well they see and hear. Some can't see, some can't hear, but those two senses together tend to give you information from further away. Whereas, touch and taste only go as far as your body. Smell, depending upon how good your nose is, it might go, a little distance away from your body. But those are more intimate senses. And so if an author wants to, wants a reader to identify with the character, wants to pull a reader into a character's body, very often that author will combine a long range with a short range sense. For instance, if you're starting a novel, you might give a reader hearing and touch at the same time. And that'll tell you what's going on around a character. She hears a rushing river and she feels cold. So you're in her body and you know what's going on around her body before anything even starts. And it just encourages you to imagine that you're her. That's, I call it zooming in. Like the way, very often a movie will start, you'll see a picture of New York from above and then the camera will come in. The famous opening shot of West Side Story, that you're way up there and then all of a sudden you're in this neighborhood, in these people's lives. So I think that's a sort of a sensory technique that can happen in fiction.
But isn't this actually a function of our previous experience, of what we remember all these feel like?
Yeah. That's all we have to work with, and things that we've imagined that other people have told us. You hear the words rushing river. And, really all you can do is try to remember every rushing river you've ever encountered. Rushing, it's an onomatopoeic word, so it sounds a little like what it is, but you all you have to work with is your memory.
Yes, very interesting aspects. Because I was thinking of cases where we haven't actually experienced particular situation. Obviously, we come from different cultures. Well, yeah. So for example, one question was at some point if somebody likes McDonald's or not, but that's actually dependent on if that person has ever had McDonald's.
Yeah, if you've ever tasted it. Yeah, so people usually don't like to read about people who are exactly like themselves. I can't speak for everyone, but I think a lot of us who read like to read about lives that are quite different from ours. But then, how do you imagine those? They're different, but like right now I'm reading Les Misérables, and I've never lived, I've never been starving and living on the streets in Paris, but so really all I can do is, so what's the hungriest I've ever been? What's the coldest I've ever been? What's the worst thing I've ever worn? What's the longest between when I ever took a shower? And you, you know, you, all you can really do is try to build on maybe the closest thing you've experienced to what these characters are going through.
Yes, it is empathy, right? So one big question from my point of view, right? So as a technologist interested in very, very similar aspects to what you are interested in, is what is actually the upper bound of this? To what extent can we push this as humans, right? Not necessarily as how we build technology to do that, but as humans, how close can we get to this lived experience of others?
I mean, the problem is that we can never know for sure what others are experiencing. And this has been a philosophical problem from the beginning that, you know, we can try to communicate with each other, but, you know, I can never know for sure what's happening in your mind. You can never know for sure what's happening in my mind. The word, like the term empathy in the last 20 years has gotten kind of out of control. You know, it's been thrown around a lot. But I think that, you know, the intentions are good. The idea is, you know, we need to try harder to imagine what other people are feeling and see things from their perspective and, you know, respect what's happening to them. So that they won't suffer as much as they're suffering. So that, I mean, that's good. And I think it, you know, we can run into trouble if we imagine that we really do have, you know, we really have captured perfectly what they're feeling, because that's not going to be possible. That we should never stop trying. And that involves exercising your imagination and also having a certain kind of humility that, you know, not presuming that you've experienced everything the world has to offer and that, you know, you can easily imagine what this other person is going through. You've got to listen to them and think, okay, well, what might they be feeling? But always be aware that, you know, you can't necessarily imagine the level of their suffering or the level of their wonderful feelings if it's something good. You know, people always talk about empathy in terms of suffering. Sometimes people have very good experiences.
Yes, for sure. Yeah. So you are a believer of this interdisciplinary approach to our understanding of lived experience. What advice do you have for researchers in various fields, you know, scientists, as well as humanities, social scientists, and even artists who are studying this problem?
You know, in order to make a valuable contribution, you really do have to dedicate yourself and learn the techniques of one discipline or one area. So I'd say, you know, work as hard as you can, you know, learning in the area that most inspires you, but at the same time, be aware of other areas and what they have to offer you. You know, talk to people from way outside of your field. It's so easy to get trapped in one little area. There's this great German word called a Fachidiot. Have you ever heard this? It's a subject idiot. It's somebody who knows all about his or her subject and nothing at all about, you know, the rest of human knowledge. And so, you know, don't be a Fachidiot. You know, try to be as good as you can in your own field, but talk to as many other people as you can in fields as different from yours as possible.
So do you think researchers should actually move toward this concept of Da Vinci's universal man, right? Or universal person. A person who is actually good at almost everything, right? Science, art, and anything that requires some creation or creative processes.
Yeah, it's, you know, in 2022, it's just not possible anymore because there's so much knowledge, there's so much information, there's so many different fields. I'd say, don't stick to one field to the extent of excluding everything else. Learn what as much as you can learn in the field that you love. But listen to other people, talk to other people, and be open to what's going on in painting or music or software writing. You know, what you were telling me about algorithms was very interesting to me. You know, I'd like to learn more about that. So Yes, I mean, it's not possible to be the universal person anymore and learn everything about everything because there's too much to know. But, you know, you have to maintain humility, I think, to be, you know, to be a really good thinker.
Yes, and I really hope that we in technology, in particular artificial intelligence, develop a little bit of more humility and really agree that building systems as complex as those that try to mimic human behavior or understand human-to-human, human-to-computer interaction really requires other areas besides math and statistics and machine learning.
And what's human, right? You know, we got a grandmother in Mexico, a blind person in Canada, you know, a marathon runner in Kenya, you know, who there's so many different ways of being human. You know, you need to take a pretty broad sample before you can train artificial intelligence to act human.
Yes, we should see what actually the future is going to bring to us.
Yeah.
Well, we are at the end now of our discussion session here, Laura. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciated your willingness to be here with us today. This was great. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, thank you. And mulțumesc mult.
This was so unexpected. Cu plăcere. It is my pleasure. It's really such a big surprise that you end now this show with an expression in Romanian, which is my mother tongue. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.